Though with the wind chill, it feels like 30. At Chicago, at O'Hare Airport, it's sunny and 40 degrees. In Joliet, sunny and 39 with a wind chill of 34. In Kankakee, it is 39 right now. Again, the wind chill is making it feel like 33. In Macomb, mostly sunny and 37 degrees. Bloomington, Illinois, it is sunny and 41. Decatur, it is 40 degrees. Peoria, it is 42. And Springfield, sunny and 44. In Rantoul right now, it's sunny and 42, and in Mattoon, it is also 42 degrees. At Willard Airport in Champaign, it is sunny and 39, dew point of 31, and the wind chill is making it feel like 31 degrees at the moment. At Friends Plaza in Urbana, right outside of our studios, it is 42 degrees. You're listening to The Afternoon Magazine on WYLL AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home, located at the corner of Elm and University in the historic Trevett Mansion, across from Westside Park in downtown Champaign. Owens Funeral Home, owned and operated by the Owens family since 1925, invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
You're listening to The Afternoon Magazine, and if you're like me, you were surprised last week when you heard some of the big numbers being thrown around about Jesse Jackson Jr.'s potential sentence. Some places were reporting that he could be going away for as long as 50 years. Have you ever wondered how judges decide on what sentences to give following a conviction? There are some firm guidelines about how they come to these decisions, and Travis McDade takes a look at it in this week's Legal Issues in the News.
Most people in the United States could get through their lives quite happily without knowing anything about the federal sentencing guidelines, unless you are a very specific type of attorney or a very specific type of criminal. The iron rule of federal sentencing will probably never darken your day. But for Illinois residents, things are different. Prominent politicians in this state get brought up on federal criminal charges with such regularity that there is profit in knowing a bit about the guidelines, even if only to read the news. The federal sentencing guidelines were created in the mid-1980s in a hugfest of bipartisanship that hasn't been seen since, well, the mid-1980s. Sentencing at the time was, and in some state systems today, still is, haphazard. People convicted of similar crimes would get radically different sentences, some of which seem to be based on race or socioeconomic status or even geography. So the guidelines meant to standardize sentences. Two people, even if they were in different parts of the country and came from different backgrounds, would get a similar sentence for the same crime. Another component of the guidelines was truth in sentencing. People sentenced to a term of 5 years, for instance, could not be paroled after 6 months. This truth in sentencing part, at least, seemed an easy fix. But the consistency of sentencing looked a bit trickier. So the Sentencing Commission went with numbers and a grid. Crimes, along with aggravating or mitigating circumstances, were assigned numbers. These, when summed, left the sentencing judge with a final tally from 1 to 43, running down the vertical side of this grid. The second part of the grid, the horizontal line, was for criminal history. This, divided into 6 rows, ranged from no criminal background to a prolific criminality. Once these 2 numbers were figured, a line was drawn across from crime level and down from criminal history. Where they intersected was an area with still more numbers, a range of months that a judge could pick a sentence from. Okay, so that might be a bit difficult in the abstract. So here is how it just worked for former Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. His base offense level for theft or embezzlement was 6. He got another 2 levels added for misrepresenting his work on behalf of the government, another 2 for being the organizer or leader of the scheme, and another 2 for abuse of trust. He then got fully 14 more levels added for the amount of money involved. That comes to a total of 26. Jackson got a 2-level reduction for acceptance of responsibility, which in his case includes an allocution in court, and another 1-level reduction for his guilty plea. So his ultimate crime level was 23. The other part of the equation, the criminal history category, was a 1, the lowest level. The line from level 23 crime intersects the line from a level 1 criminal history at a range of from 46 to 57 months in prison. That gives the sentencing judge the discretion to give Jackson anywhere from just under 4 years in prison to just under 5 years. Now, there are 2 guideline complicating factors. The first was built into the system, and it allows a judge to depart from the prescribed range of months if the judge senses some factor not adequately taken into account by the guidelines. The other wrinkle is that the guidelines are no longer mandatory, thanks to a 2005 Supreme Court decision. Federal judges should and do calculate the guideline range, but they do not have to hew as closely to it as they once did. What that means in practical terms is this. 10 years ago, Jackson would be looking at a prison sentence of around 4 years based on his guideline range. Now, I expect it will be a great deal less than that, and maybe as little as half. We'll know for sure in a few weeks. I'm Travis McDade.
Tonight, we are going to see some freezing rain and possibly a mix of snow and flurries and all sorts of stuff. And if we're unlucky, we may also see a little bit of hail. Hail causes about $1 billion in damage to U.S. property and crops every year. Insurers would like to minimize those losses, and that's where the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety comes in. Earlier this month, the Institute created a full-scale hailstorm inside of a laboratory. The idea was to study why the damage can get so bad. Julie Rose of NPR member station WFAE has this report.
Tanya Brown has had a single obsession these past 2 years.
I'm a research engineer and the lead engineer on this project.
How to make hail.
The standard tests that are out there use distilled water or tap water or even steel balls, and we tried to take it to the next level to make sure that the density was as realistic as possible. So we measured over 10,000 hailstones before we came up with the recipe that we use today.
Brown and other scientists from the Insurance Institute for Business and Home Safety chased storms across the Midwest, weighing and crushing hailstones to see just how dense they were. Plain old frozen water turned out to be a bad match for the real deal. So Brown's team turned to a secret ingredient.
The recipe is 80% seltzer, 20% tap water, and we use that seltzer water to actually cause bubbles as the ice freezes, which actually helps us control the density to make it more realistic.
They spent months injecting the concoction into molds by hand and using a deep freezer to create perfectly round hailstones ranging from 1 to 2 inches. And now, Brown is 60 feet up in the rafters of this cavernous warehouse, ready to unleash hail with a weapon made just for this occasion. Engineer Ian Giamanco is in the control room, finger on the trigger.
It's almost a glorified potato gun. I mean, it's very similar.
A click of his mouse will force compressed air through about a dozen of the cannons, firing some 9,000 handmade hailstones at speeds up to 80 miles per hour.
Safety off in 3, 2, 1, 1 inch fire. Group 2, fire.
We watch through a glass window as a small but still full-size house rotates slowly on a giant turntable. It's built with a patchwork of materials and techniques to test their resistance to hail. There's also a shiny black car, some patio furniture, and a child's toy or two. From here, the cannon fire is muffled. But out in the lab, hail clatters off the roof, batters the rain gutter, shatters the car windshield. After 4 minutes of unrelenting ice fury, stillness.
All right, the artificial hailstorm is finished, and now everybody in there hard hats has moved in to inspect. There's a lot of folks here from the insurance industry, which funds this research institute. They're particularly interested in different types of building materials, how they hold up under extreme weather, and of course that plays into the kinds of coverage that they offer as well.
My name is Brian Cook with Amica Insurance. Really, the only way to really get a handle on insurance costs is to reduce the risk of loss. And if we can do things through mitigation and strengthening our homes, we accomplish that task, and it's better for everybody.
The Insurance Institute of Business and Home Safety uses these experiments to back up their fight for stronger building codes and better construction materials. Previous tests have simulated hurricanes, tornadoes, and wildfire, funded entirely by the insurance industry.
We are the only multi-hazard lab of our kind, so we are obsessed equally with wind, water, fire, and hail.
Institute CEO Julie Rochman estimates the hailstorm cost about $500,000 to pull off.
I think we figured out that each hailstone probably costs about $2,000.
Engineers will now detail every ding and dent in the house to figure out which types of shingles, siding, and windows did best. Age of the materials is another key factor they'll be testing, with a series of roofs already sprouting up in a field just outside the test chamber. Will those get the homemade hail treatment too?
Hail yes, as we like to say. Hail yes.
For NPR News, I'm Julie Rhodes.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at SubaruofChampaign.com.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 25th of February, 2013. It's the birthday of Anthony Burgess, born in Manchester, England, 1917. Majored in English literature, joined the army. He was good at languages. He moved ahead in military intelligence, got a job with the British Colonial Service. He was posted to Malaysia, became fluent in Malaysian, taught in a boys' school, wrote novels for pleasure on the side, went off to a teaching post in Borneo, started to get headaches, and then one day collapsed in front of the classroom. He was flown back to London, where doctors said he had a brain tumor, inoperable. He had 1 year to live, and he didn't have a job. He had no money to spend that terminal year traveling, so he started out to make money for his widow and wrote at a furious pace, wrote 5 novels in 1 year, and it turned out he did not have a brain tumor, and he did not die. Kept writing at a furious pace, outlived his wife by many years, eventually died of lung cancer in 1993, 30 books and 30 years later. Wrote his most famous book, A Clockwork Orange, in just 3 weeks in 1962, which was inspired by a tragic experience of his and his wife's. Soon after he was married, when his wife was pregnant, she was mugged by 4 young American Army deserters in London and afterward miscarried their child. A Clockwork Orange, set in future England, featuring a teenage anti-hero, Alex, who leads his gang of friends on acts of random violence, but in the end grows up and realizes that violence is a bore, and he wants to marry and have a child. That last chapter was cut off the American edition of A Clockwork Orange, and also left off the movie by Stanley Kubrick, which irritated Anthony Burgess, the fact that the novel and the film seemed to glorify sex and violence, and had left off the chapter about maturity and redemption. Here's a poem for today by Paul Hastowski, entitled Trombone Lesson. The 20 minutes from 9:30 to 9:50 is actually slightly longer than the 20 minutes from 9:50 to 9:10, which is half downhill, as anyone who's ever stared at the hillocky face of a clock in the 5th grade will tell you. My trombone lesson with Mr. Lester was out the classroom door and down the tessellating hallway to the band room, which was full of empty chairs and music stands, from 10:10 to 10:40,